Coming up today, our government is getting tough on British ISPs and their use of internet filtering, and it wants answers. Plus, a teenager has spent 2,000 hours building an expansion to a video game in the hope that the game's original developer will give him a job building video games. And it turns out that Radiohead's Thom Yorke wears knickers, and they're in a twist! Figuratively, of course. Plus, your feedback and views on last week's stories, along with an exploration of how cameras on mobile phones are going from good to amazeballs to holy crap, what's the point of all these pixels? It's all coming up over the next 30 minutes. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting, from science and tech to nomads in the music industry. I'm your host, Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk.
And I'm Leah Clark.
And I'm Katie Collins.
And this week we are sans Liv, again.
Yeah.
Poor Liv, busy partying, relaxing, putting her hooves up.
In Ibiza.
Well, we're going to be back with Liv next week. Later on in the show, we are going to be welcoming David Rowan, actually, into the studio, editor of Wired magazine, or the print version of Wired.co.uk, as I sometimes like to call it, to talk about our Will.i.am feature that's been doing pretty amazingly well over the last couple of weeks, I have to say. I'm going to hear some feedback about what it was like getting this feature put together and the kind of things that we learnt along the way about Will.i.am and his process and entrepreneurialism and stuff like that. I can't really say that word. But first, the news. Liat.
Nate.
Looking at you.
Hi there.
Stung by mosquitoes recently.
Oh, yeah, they've destroyed me.
Leaked letters are showing that the government is leaning on ISPs over internet filtering.
Yeah, so the government has obviously made it pretty clear in the last few months that it is serious about protecting children online. There's been a bit of a ruckus about it and people want steps to be made. So it supports this plan for internet service providers, the major ones, Be Sky, Be Talk Talk, Virgin Media and BT, to have filters on as default so that we can protect the nation's children.
And this is to block by default, you know, nudie ladies.
Yeah, basically a letter has been leaked from the Department for Education to all four major ISPs, which shows that the government basically is not taking no for an answer. It basically tells them what they want them to say. It wants the wording of parental filters to be swapped from Active Choice Plus, where they basically have to go through a series of options and actually think about what they're doing and why and how.
Active Choice Plus is the stupidest name for anything an ISP could possibly do. It means nothing. It absolutely has zero connotation.
Would you prefer default on? Because that's what apparently the PM would like you to announce. Well, ISPs by the end of the year that you will have.
Parental filter sounds pretty good to me.
The ISPs had a problem, didn't they, with the term default on?
Yeah.
Why? What was that?
Well, they're basically saying it implies if you say yes to this, then everything harmful is blocked, and it's not necessarily the case. And you actually have to go through, and you should be kind of reading everything and ticking other boxes, and also they think it will make parents complacent and think, oh, if I tick that, I'm not going to have to monitor anything more because it will block everything. And of course, you're never going to be able to stop everything from getting through, and kids are going to, you know, be able to circumvent this at some point.
And I suppose the other risk is that if parents just think that filtering's always on, then they're going to stop checking that kids aren't accidentally seeing
stuff they shouldn't see. And so they say this is very misleading, and we would prefer, I mean, their argument for the active plus on that type of thing is that you are actively having to go and click on it and have choices and read about it and think about it rather than just having default on, not having to do anything about it. But apparently the PM would like ISPs to announce that's going to be the wording by the end of the year. They also want...
But hang on, sorry. Is this just about wording? I mean, is the actual active process of filtering up for question here, or is it just what are we calling it?
Well, the ISPs, yeah, are irked about what are we calling it. It is going to be the same for now. But there's other things down the line where they want assurances that they're going to have age verification and identity verification for anyone to change to tick the filter.
Sounds
rushed.
And
that hasn't all been decided.
Yeah, this should not be pushed through until all ISPs are on board,
yeah,
and these sorts of circumventions and forethought has happened,
yeah,
because we've seen this go wrong in the past where decisions get made very, very quickly, whether it's to do with cookies or censorship or whatever, you know, DRM, things like that, where they don't think about the consequences,
yeah,
and it becomes a big fat mess.
Absolutely. And I think you're getting a bit of insight into how that happens here, because the letter is just hilariously worded. It says stuff like, you know, we're going to have this awareness campaign for parents. We don't really know what it's going to be. We don't really know the format. We're going to research it. But the PM would like to know how much money you're willing to commit to this, and we'd like to be able to announce that
and
to the public.
And we'd like to give it a brand.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, that
we would like to announce this by the end of the year, so do it. But we don't know how we're going to do it, why, what, where, when.
Well, we're obviously going to have to keep a close eye on this because it will basically affect the majority of internet users, given the ISPs that are on board with this. But I do think that it's going to have to be more than just what are we going to put on the poster on the trains that advertises to parents that this is happening, and a bit more about what is the due process for someone wanting to opt out or, you know.
Well, most of this is actually applicable for new customers, and there's like the other debate of how new customers will automatically be given this option. For existing customers, the format is not yet decided.
Right. Well, we have spoken. We have a question mark, and we would like some answers before the PM makes any decisions about brands. Katie, let's turn to strangers. This morning, I saw a stranger on the tube. I was like, was he a stranger? Because I recognise him. A study has come out that addresses this issue.
Phenomenon. Yes. So this is about the idea of familiar strangers. So people that you don't know and, you know, you've never spoken to necessarily, but who you come across regularly during your daily life and perhaps you start to recognise. So I don't know if you have any of these kind of...
I do,
but you know what? It's a bit sad.
Why?
No, you should tell. You should say.
What, say hello to them?
Say who they are.
No, right. There's a homeless man that I walk past every morning on the way to
work. Oh, no. Well, we all... Yeah.
And I don't
know who you mean.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. But he's a stranger, but he's familiar.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. This isn't the news. That's
no,
old.
That's another topic.
What's this study about?
So the study is looking at... It's the first study of its kind to sort of look at how this works across a whole metropolitan area. So it's taken Singapore as an example, and it's worked by analysing travel smart car data from people travelling on buses. It's about 20 million journeys in all across a week. What it's shown is that there are about 18 million in-vehicle encounters between two individuals who sort of recognised each other.
So is that's basically the study looking at this card was used to get on this bus and this card was used to get on the same bus and that happened on multiple occasions. Thus, the two people were in the same bus at the same time.
Yes.
Okay.
It's found that about 85% of the recurring interactions happened at the same time every day, and that people were more likely to encounter familiar strangers in the morning than in the afternoon.
Well, that makes sense.
Definitely.
When you think about commuting times, most people get the same train every day.
Yeah, and probably they're more likely to get they're more likely to have a set start time
in the morning,
and then and then, you know, go their separate ways at the end of the day. So it definitely makes sense. It makes sense to me. The other thing that it kind of found that was strangers kind of it takes quite a long time for people to get to recognize each other, and but the authors want to use this to basically try and work out whether this is a way that communities are formed within metropolitan areas. So like the idea that, you know, you might go from noticing each other to unintentionally interacting, you know, like bumping elbows or whatever, and then intentionally communicating, and
does
then
that
maybe
happen?
This is the thing where it could be something that depends on the territory, because I don't honestly think in London anyone does, because if someone talks to you on the tube, I think everyone assumes you're either mad or violent.
Or they fancy you.
Yeah. Mm. Whereas in other parts of the world, I mean, I notice this even when I go back up home in a town in Derbyshire called Buxton, and people there, they seem happier to be around other people up there.
It's very pleasant.
People know each other and they talk to each other, and people sit on the bus next to each other and strike up a conversation. Whereas if you do that in London, you'll get funny looks at best or being moved away from at worst.
Yeah, it's like that where I come from, and it's quite sad because the other morning someone said good morning to me and I just kind of like spluttered, hi, nice weather, and then giggled because I was just like so taken aback.
The weather. So the end result is to figure out whether these sorts of social interactions are kind of helping communities form.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I see. I do wonder if that happens in places where you're all at the same place at the same time, but only for a brief period of time. I'll cut round the crap. Festivals. So one of the things I notice about festivals is that this does happen a lot. And quite often, that's how you end up talking to someone, because you've seen them earlier on at the festival.
Yeah.
And then you bump into them again, and there's kind of that mutual connection.
That's more a natural mini community, though, because you're all there for the same thing, and you're all interested in the same thing.
True.
You know, not on your morning commute when it's just... You're all going your separate ways.
Similar studies have been done before in these kind of like in sort of kind of if you go to like a convention or something like that and you know found this, but this is the first time that they've looked at how it works across a whole city.
Awesome.
And it kind of creates this web of people that are interlinked throughout the whole of the city.
I love stuff like this. Yeah. I really do. I think this is like I could get on board with reading these sorts of studies all day, every day. Well, let us know. podcast@wired.co.uk. We'll read out some examples on next week's show. If you have met a stranger as a result of being regular strangers, podcast@wired.co.uk. Let's hear some examples of how that has worked.
You're already listening to the wired.co.uk podcast, but you might have a friend who is less fortunate. Why not send them a postcard with wired.co.uk/podcast written on the back so they can join in?
A teenager called Alexander Velicky. Liat, does that name ring a bell? I mean, it will do because...
It will because I've read the story. Yeah. Well, but it's a wonderful name as well. You're not going to forget that.
It's a good name, yeah. Well, he spent 2,000 hours of his life building an expansion pack to the Elder Scrolls RPG role-playing game Skyrim, which incorporated original voice acting from 30 actors, 26 playable missions... big things in the game to do, and it results in about 30 hours of game time, which is about twice the average length of a standard game anyway.
That's insane.
But he is not employed by the company that makes this game, Bethesda. He has instead done this as something of a big fat CV. He built this expansion pack to try and get a job at Bethesda, and he had a lot of support from his dad, who was able to live rent-free. He didn't have to be in education or working, so he basically spent his entire life for 2,000 hours building this giant expansion pack to try and say you should hire me. And to be perfectly honest, they probably should.
I hope they have. Yeah. I mean that's insane.
Have they said whether they're going to give him a job yet?
We haven't heard that, but the thing is, like, it's got to be. It's absolutely got to be. I mean, these sorts of expansion packs take, at least for these sorts of games as well, like teams of dozens of people at least. Some of these games, you know, 100 to 300 people sometimes. But for the expansions, you know, you would expect at least 40, 50, 60 people to be working on them for several months.
Yeah.
And this guy's done it all on his own, all the art. Wow.
He's set the bar pretty high for any future job application.
It's really impressive. I mean, like, there's not much more to say about the story than that, but just a great bit of initiative that I think it's particularly interesting because this is the sort of thing that wasn't necessarily available to people of his age, even in that recent history, sort of more than about 15 years ago or so, because computing power in the home wasn't sufficient enough to be able to design levels and everything on a single machine and things like that. You know, you would need to be in a much bigger environment with, you know, racks of hard drives and stuff like that. So it's a really interesting way of proving your worth, if you like. And there have always been fan mods and you know, people who have got teams of friends together and collaborators over the internet to remake games. A really good example actually was a remake of the original Half-Life, and it was called Black Mesa, and it was created over many, many years, I think 7 or 8 years or something, by a collaborative team who basically rebuilt the entirety of the Half-Life game using the developer tools that that Valve used to create Half-Life 2. And they did it from scratch, and they had support from Valve as well, but they basically just did it all in their spare time for free. And
that's incredible.
But again, that took teams of people years in their spare time to do collaboratively. This chap's done it on his own. Well, I think it's impressive.
Really?
Someone
impressive.
Should hire him. In fact, yeah. If Bethesda doesn't, somebody should.
Yeah.
Because clearly the dude's got skill. Well, that's going to do it for the first half of the show. In the second half, we're going to explore how megapixels are changing the camera photography world. But immediately when we come back, we're going to be joined by David Rowan, and we're going to find out the backstory behind Will.i.am's inclusion in our magazine. Who would like a free audiobook? Most people, probably. Audible.co.uk is offering you, the listener, any book from its catalogue of 80,000 titles for being a Wired.co.uk podcast listener. Now, we mention this every week, but you do get a one-month free trial of Audible.co.uk from audible.co.uk/wired, which costs no pounds and no pence, and whatever you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account. So it's a good time to maybe catch up the Steve Jobs biography if you didn't get it the first time round. So head to audible.co.uk/wired, sign up in a few seconds and download that book, or indeed any book. You'll be supporting our show every week, which we love, and you get a free book as a thank you. We hope you like it. audible.co.uk/wired.
Business can be creative when creative people are doing business. My name is Will I Am, and I am the guest editor for this issue of Wired magazine.
The words there from Mr. Will I Am, who's the cover star of our new issue of Wired, discussing not music, but innovation, business, technology. Joining me now, Mr. David Rowan, editor of the magazine. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Nate.
So I'm just going to jump right into this. How did we end up working with Will I Am on this project?
You're right. We don't usually have pop stars on our cover. But I kept hearing from people in the industry I respect, well, I just had a meeting with Will I Am. He seems to know where the tech trends are going in the next couple of years, or he's building a hardware business, or he's investing in a lot of really quite fast-growing West Coast companies. And so I thought, well, it's a bit weird, but he's quite interesting. And the more I read into it, the more I realized that this guy is an advisor, a creative advisor to Intel. He's working with Coca-Cola to try and get their EcoCycle project growing. He is traveling every couple of days on an aeroplane. He's going to, you know, South Korea and then Brazil and then Tokyo. And he's incredibly ADHD and curious. And so he's interviewing people and meeting entrepreneurs and meeting art students in all these places. And he's synthesizing out of all this, this is where not just the music trends are going, but this is where the user interface trends are going. This is where the consumer hardware trends are going. And then he's taking that knowledge to corporates. And I thought, he's going to have a fantastic network. Why don't we work with him and bring in some of the extraordinary people he meets in South Korea or Brazil and tell their stories with a bit of help from Will I Am?
So you suggested this as an idea to him. Was it something he thought, yes, that's a great idea, definitely want to do that? Or
I sent an email to him after a recommendation from, I got both Ejaz Ahmed of AKQA and Danny Cohen of BBC Television. And about, you know, it was a kind of formal, polite English editor writes in, you know, dear Mr. I Am, or whatever you say. we're interested in talking to you about this project. And within about 45 seconds, I got a stream of consciousness email back from him that read like haikus, which kind of was creatively exploding. And I thought, you know, this might go somewhere. And it ended up having a couple of interviews, one in Los Angeles, which started at his publicist's office. And then halfway through, he said, you want to get sushi? And so we went in his not quite street legal sports car that he's designed that has two iPads but no seatbelts to a kind of Nobu restaurant in Hollywood. And then like another 3 hours, I had like 5 hours of tape to transcribe, which came to about 24,000 words. Will I Am comes with an army of people around him. He's got traveling with him, you know, the hardware people. He's got the food people, he's got the performance people, he's got the music production people, he's got the advising the corporation people. And we tapped into that network and got some really, really good leads that we followed up in the start section, in the play section, in the how-to section, and also in the feature section. So, you know, for example, he's been doing some work with Dean Kamen, the inventor of the Segway, to try and make science cooler among school-age kids. And so we went to see Dean Kamen. Adam Higginbotham wrote a great piece, spent some time there, about Kamen's next projects, including his slingshot, trying to create a machine that will purify water in a hostile environment. So the Will I Am main interview story, I was thinking, So the average Wired reader is not going to want to know what he's been doing with Beyonce. He's, you know, or Britney, or, you know, it's not that kind of story. It's about how you can take a creative mind from one industry and apply that thinking, apply that mindset to other kinds of business. So I was really looking for his experience and his lessons that he'd learned that anybody reading Wired could start thinking about, if not applying in their work. So it's how you can get that maker culture going in your organization. It's how you can spot the trends by observing popular culture.
I think the response has been pretty good. I mean, I know a lot of people were skeptical seeing a pop star, someone they associate with Black Eyed Peas on the cover, and sort of reading through this, I think, got a sense of a very different sort of person.
We have on our letters page, our rants page in the next issue, a sliding scale of Twitter feedback, and it starts at the top going dope, and then at the bottom, nope. But obviously there's a risk of, oh, is Wired going to jump the shark? It's got a mainstream celebrity on the cover. But we never saw him in that context. We were interested in, very specifically, he's investing with Ron Conway in the Valley. He's going into a lot of startups, trying to understand what makes them tick. So he's a kind of a frontline observer in this fast-changing trend world. There's going to be some snark, but Nate, we're in the media.
Yeah.
You run a website. There's a bit of snark.
I'm paid in snark. Well, that brings me then to the last quick question. He's worked with us on our publication. Are you going to be doing any guest vocals on his next album?
The very strange thing was, we were sitting...
Please don't say yes.
We were sitting in this restaurant, and, like, you know, 4 hours, 52 minutes in, and he was telling me how he goes about the process of writing a song. So he says, should I try and do his accent? It's going to be really bad if I do. But so he was saying, so I'm in a studio with this girl. He wouldn't say who it was, but you can kind of guess. And so I always start with, so what's on your mind? And she's saying, well, my boyfriend, he's been so beastly to me. He's been treating me so bad. Why's that? Well, he just thinks I'm flirting with guys. And are you flirting with guys? Well, no. Hey, no. Just like normal stuff. Is he looking at girls? Well, I guess. So maybe it's him being guilty about that and taking... So there's my first line for the song. So he's starting to explain the whole kind of composing a song. And so then I'm thinking, so if he asks me what's on my mind, I'm going to say, Will I Am. My on my mind is all these deadlines I'm kind of missing. So he goes, oh, well, I got the lines. It's like, I can't make my deadline. That's going to be my headline. And I'm thinking, this is the most surreal moment of my, you know, very, very long journalistic career. I'm sitting in here with Will I Am, but no, I did not sing, and no, I will not be going to the studio with him.
The last portion of our show for this week, our segment portion, we have two slices of segment cake this week, and the first, it's a new segment that we are titling, sorry, what's the point?
What the?
Now, this is a new segment with a weird name, and this isn't a dismissive, critical segment, but this is a part of the show where we want to say, that's interesting. Do we need this?
Why are they doing this?
Why is this happening? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Something with a bit of dividing opinion behind it. So, this week, Nokia announced the Lumia 1020, which is a Windows phone. So far, so normal, but it's got a 41 megapixel camera. And this is in a time where, if you look at your iPhone, your Android, whatever you've got, chances are it's between about 5 and 10 megapixels. The iPhone 5's camera is 8 megapixels. The Galaxy S4 is, I think, 13 megapixels. We've also seen the likes of the HTC One, arguably the S4's main Android rival, which decided to just do 4 megapixels, but they call them ultra pixels, and they're supposed to be better pixels. So there's all this talk of pixels, and then Nokia comes out with this 41 megapixel number that appears to crush the digits even offered by high-end SLRs from like Canon and Nikon and Sony that are often about 15, 20, 25 megapixels. What's going on?
I don't know what to believe about pixels anymore. I feel like they're just squeezing in imaginary pixels into a pixel.
Well, a lot of people think that people hold too much, they put too much emphasis on megapixels, don't they?
They do. They do. It's a megapixels race. Kind of how the gigahertz race was several years ago in the PC world. It's not determined by number. It's determined by quality. It's actually determined by a lot of things that will never make the box of the product you're buying, such as quality, sensor size, all these sorts of things. So we wanted to talk about this one because it has made a bit of an impact. First, a few little bits of technical detail about the phone. So it is a Windows phone. It comes in bright yellow, dual core 1.5 gigahertz processor, 4.0 inch AMOLED screen, so similar to the Samsung's there. It's quite high end for a Windows phone, but many Android phones are now quad core. They have far more memory, more sensors, things like that. But in the Windows phone sphere, it's a pretty good phone. It's on par with, you know, the highest end Windows phones, certainly. The camera itself, the main bit, 41 megapixels. Now, the easiest way to explain this is A, not all megapixels are the same size. And that means if you have smaller megapixels, you can fit more of them on a sensor. If you have a bigger sensor than average, you can fit even more of those pixels in the phone. And that's kind of what's happening here. So you've got an image sensor. That's the little black square that captures light when the camera shutter opens. In this phone, it's bigger than what you'll find on a regular camera phone camera. But the pixels on that sensor are also much, much smaller. So it's not dissimilar to how, you know, when the iPhone went Retina, got its Retina display, it looks much, much crisper because the pixels are smaller and so they can fit more of them in the same space. Yeah. And that gives the overall effect of a much tighter, sharper, crisper screen. It's kind of like that in reverse, in that instead of displaying light, it's capturing light. So with all that, it's able to capture effectively more pixels. But because the pixels are smaller, they're not necessarily capturing the same amount. Well, they're not capturing the same amount of light as a normal camera. And so that reduces us to the question, are more but smaller pixels better than fewer bigger pixels, i.e. HTC One or a regular smartphone?
I have no idea.
No, well,
are they?
It's very difficult to tell with these things until you actually see the results compare them
results
side by side.
Pretty cool for.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Nokia. So we've got some pictures now taken on the camera, and they do look amazing. Mm. And the camera will take two different types of photograph. It takes two at the same time, rather. One version that it takes is the full on. The full-size photo taken, it actually saves, I think, around 38 megapixels in total. But, it's around the 40-megapixel mark. And then it also saves a smaller 5-megapixel version. And this is important because the 5-megapixel one is actually the one that you're probably going to want to be using because it's the one that's more similar in size to what you're getting off other phones. It's a much more manageable upload to Facebook and things like that. Yep. And the reason why that photograph is going to be so much more different to the other phones that also have 5-megapixel sensors is because every pixel in that image has been formed from 7 of these small pixels that the camera is able to capture. And so it means it's able to, rather than having to have one pixel determine just one color, it's able to effectively have 7 pixels decide what generally is the best color for this pixel to be, and then to save that into one pixel. So the result is much more accurate, much more realistic colors, blacks, presentation, things like that. And the results we've seen so far do suggest that the pictures are better, but also that selling something purely based on having 41 megapixels is completely irrelevant.
They are tricksters.
And if other phones come out and say, we've got 41 megapixel sensors, then really the best thing to do is to Google the results.
Yeah. We need a new rating system.
We really
do. They are really screwing with our knowledge of pixels.
It's
hey guys, you can squeeze 7 in 1. I didn't know that till today.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
But this is one of
I'm sorry.
this is one of the great things about sort of publishing online, actually, is that, I mean, we do that. We're not the only site that does this, but whenever we review phones, we always, without exception, take several photographs in different lighting conditions with the camera, and then we put those online. So you can look at the full res photos and you can just see, like, does that one look better than that one? And if so, then great, buy that one. It doesn't actually matter then what megapixel count made that picture necessarily, anything more than just it looks good. Well, we've already got a preview on the website, hands-on, with some photos. If you search for Lumia 1020 on wired.co.uk, you will find our initial write-up, which Katie and I put together, along with probably about 10 or 11, 12 sample photos taken with the camera, so which you can look at full screen, HD, check that out. It's impressive. I think it's good. It's going to be out later this year, by the way.
If you've been affected by any of the issues raised on this week's podcast, why not tell us about them? The team is waiting for your comment at facebook.com/wiredUK.
For our last segment of the day. Oh, no, they didn't. This week, oh, no, they didn't, Tom York calls on Spotify to give artists a fairer deal. Katie, knickers firmly twisted.
Yes.
They have been de-legged and twisted.
So Tom York went on a bit of a Twitter rant. It's always quite exciting when a celebrity goes on a Twitter rant. And basically said that he was removing his solo album, The Eraser, from Spotify. And along with Nigel Godrich, who also went on a... I think that's how you pronounce it, isn't it? Godrich. Also went on a Twitter rant, probably a bigger Twitter rant actually, they've both removed their music that they've recorded with Atoms for Peace.
Yeah, now not the first time we've seen music pulled from Spotify. There've been entire record labels that have axed their catalog over not getting paid enough money. But what's Tom York's beef?
So basically, they're saying that this isn't anything to do with actually that they're not being paid enough. They are angry and annoyed that that new artists aren't really getting a fair cut when their music is on Spotify, and they don't think that Spotify are doing enough to help new artists.
No, but it's, yeah, definitely. And there are a couple of choice quotes here. One that he tweeted says, quote, "Make no mistake, new artists you discover on Spotify will not get paid. Meanwhile, shareholders will shortly begin rolling it in." And then later on he said, Godrich added, "The numbers don't even add up for Spotify yet, but it's not about that. It's about establishing the model which will be extremely valuable. Meanwhile, small labels and new artists can't keep their lights on. It's just not right."
Basically, his point is that it's fine for older bands that have already got a back catalogue of work. You know, they can upload the whole
thing.
They're
making money.
Yeah, they're basically just making money from the royalties. So, I mean, not maybe as much money as they would from CDs, but... newer bands that haven't had a chance to establish themselves through CD sales and record sales over the years are now not being able to, you know, bring in enough money.
It's a two-headed shark sort of thing, if such a thing exists.
Because
there's got to be seen as a difference between money and value, right? One of the things that Spotify does incredibly well is discovery, whether it's through suggesting artists that you might like because you like other artists, that can bring up independent bands, new bands, releases you've never heard of, and it's something it does very, very well. Now, those artists might not get the same payback that they would get if they sold a £10 CD from Amazon and the label gives them, you know, a few pence or a pound or whatever for that. But it does mean that that band is getting noticed. Yeah. That leads to viral word-of-mouth marketing, so on and so forth. And so there are two different ways, I think, to judge the value of something like Spotify. And it's not, as Jesse J, I believe, said, about the money.
Thing.
I just quoted Jesse J.
Yeah.
I should chop that
out. Wow.
Okay, so what does Tom York suggest here? Does he have an answer for this financial quandary?
He doesn't have an answer for it as such. He hasn't said that there's, you know, there'll be a situation in which that he will consider putting his music back on Spotify.
And I think the other thing, though, to bear in mind, I guess, is that Spotify is making money, whereas piracy made none.
Yes, and that's another of Spotify's arguments.
But it's a sensible argument.
It is.
But it does put them in a really awkward position where on the one hand, they might be doing good in getting people away from illegitimate sources of music and at least bringing people back into the idea of paying something for music. But on the other hand, to a band that sees someone else making money doing that and having a problem with that, they may prefer the BitTorrent alternative, perhaps, if it means that someone isn't profiting off charging or making very, very little money for the bands, which puts Spotify and sites like Spotify in a very awkward position. And I do think we're probably only seeing still the early days of this sort of blooming business model kind of playing out. We've got some feedback that we wanted to get to. Now, who shall we start with the feedback? Liat. Adam Selby has written in.
Hey, Wired UK podcast team. Love the idea of paper helmets, and one thought popped to mind when I heard it. Disposable recycled paper bike helmet vending machines at Boris Barclay bike terminals with deposits as well, so they can be recycled back into more helmets. What do you think? You could even offer them for free by selling advertising on them.
This goes back to our story, I think, from last week, where we talked about the company or the person that is developing disposable bike helmets made out of paper.
I think Adam's onto something here.
I think it's a brilliant idea, personally, because I am not really a cyclist. And every time I think about going to get one of the Boris bikes, I'm, you know, put off by the fact that I don't own my own helmet.
Yeah. And you don't want to buy
one.
And
also, I don't want to carry
just
one.
Just for that reason.
Yeah, so I think that this is brilliant. And he's even thought up a business model behind it and, you know, how to fund it. Nate, you don't look convinced.
I'm just not a fan of bikes.
Doesn't feel...
Oh, yeah, well... I'm not in London particularly.
No, it's terrifying.
It's really
definitely
scary.
Definitely wear a helmet. Yeah. People.
I'm not sure the advertising would necessarily work if you're recycling the helmets after use. It kind of reminds me a little bit of my idea to have advertising on toilet paper and have the toilet paper be free, but then thinking...
Who's going to sponsor that?
No one is going to want to have their logo used in such a fashion.
Don't
so it's fun. Okay, well, Robert Gill writes in. He says, "Hi, Nate, Liv and the team. Long-time listener here. Love the podcast. I just wondered... Have you ever been on your website, wired.co.uk, and pressed up, up, down, down, left, right, BA, start? You might have to press it twice for some reason it didn't work on the first go. You should read this article." Now, Robert asks this as if we didn't know that this was there. Now, if you do that...
We do go on our site, Robert.
There is...
I definitely do.
There is a treat, a little treat on there, which we're not... really talking about that much, but yes, we were aware that something does happen if you type the Konami code into our website.
Being new, this was actually new to me, so I was very excited, and I recommend that you do it.
Yes. Yes, keep up the good work, Rob. Well, thank you, Rob. Yes, we did know about that. It is not just limited to Wired. Our developers are creative individuals, and we also have Nyan Cat.
Why did we keep it secret?
Because it's an Easter egg.
The cat's out of the
bag. You have to find it.
So that is the end of our slightly longer than usual, I think, show this week. Do write in, podcast@wired.co.uk. We get a lot of feedback. We love reading it out. If you've got any opinions on today's show, let us know. Also, don't forget, obviously, if you've been tempted by David's interview on Will I Am, that issue is still on sale. It's also on tablets, iPads, Kindles, Android, PDF download, whatever you want. wired.co.uk/magazine. You'll find all the links. Obviously, it's also in news stores, WH Smith's and supermarkets and what have you. And get a free audiobook, audible.co.uk/wired. You can download a book for free on us. I think that's it, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Cheerio.
You've finished this week's episode of the wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.